Kia ora and welcome to Sobriety Chat. I am your host, Lotta Dan, otherwise known as Mrs. D. I am the community manager and content creator here at Living Sober. And today I am joined by very lovely Greer Berry. Now, Greer is a writer. She is a journalist, an award-winning journalist. She's a PR sort of expert, media advisor person. She's a wedding celebrant. She's a wife, she's a mother, and of course she is sober. Welcome, Greer.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Oh, it's so good to see you. We've sort of interacted online, and we were going to go and see Russell Brand live together. It was going to be a lovely kind of sober girls meetup, and it was right before the pandemic hit. We never got to see Russell on stage.
That's right, in 2020, the year that, yeah,
everything exactly fell apart. Mm-hmm. But yeah, thank you so much for coming on here. It's great to chat to you. And how long have you been sober for now? When did you have your last drink?
So I did the classic New Year's Eve, I'm not going to drink for 1 year kind of plan for myself. And that was 3 years ago. So the New Year's just been, I clicked over to the 3 years, yeah.
And why? Why did you stop? Why did you quit? What was happening?
Look, I've been a really heavy drinker since my early teens. I was a really quite developed young girl, and used to be the one who got given the $20 to go into Liquorland when the licenses were still paper. And so I used to have someone's license that said I was 20 years old and go in and buy booze for all my mates, and would sit in the park and drink. And so alcohol's always been a really large part of my life, just like I think every other New Zealander pretty much. And I never really thought about it. But in 2017, 2018, my husband's in the military and he deployed overseas, and I was left at home with two little kids aged 2 and 3. Not a heck of a lot of support around me, just other military wives pretty much to support. I just found I was relying more and more on alcohol, kind of that classic mummy juice, to get through the day. And then when he came back, we went through a really, really tough time in our relationship. And my coping mechanism very much was alcohol. It was just, if I can numb this pain that I'm feeling, it'll all go away. And that was, it worked for a little bit.
Did you have that conscious thought, I'm numbing this feeling? Or was it just
absolutely
that it was just what you did?
Oh, no,
okay. So you were very aware of it.
Yeah, I was very aware of it. I was insanely aware of it, which I think kind of goes to my, I'm a really curious person. And so I'm really curious about my own behaviors. And at the time I was studying psychology. So I decided to do my master's in psychology because I'm just so interested in how the brain works. So at the same time, I was kind of becoming my own little test case of like, what is going on inside your brain? And it was actually when my husband and I were in therapy, and the therapist, and at one stage he just turned around and said to me, you know, when are we going to talk about your drinking? And I was like,
Perfect.
I don't know what you're talking about. No, I didn't say that, but I was
The therapist said that.
No, my husband.
Oh, your husband.
No, the therapist. No, therapist was on my
side.
Yeah, because we were both drinking. We were both heavy drinkers. But kind of went through that stage of, you know, when you've got kids and you don't drink so much, but then you get back into it again. And he just said, when are we going to talk about your drinking? And I was like, we will get to that, because I was so conscious of what I was doing. But I was kind of like, you know why I'm drinking, so you just shush your mouth and let me work this out. And it wasn't until he went away on a hunting trip and I was at home by myself with the kids. And it was around about November. And I remember really clearly just texting him, and he was in the middle of the bush, he had no coverage really, and I texted him and I said, I'm going to give up drinking for a year. And he was kind of like, where has this come from? He's thinking I'm having a breakdown at home. And I think it was just, I really wanted to challenge myself because I could not moderate at all. I was absolutely like most people, where I drink where I'm happy, I drink where I'm sad, I drink of any day of the week ending in day. You know, there's always that next thing, the wedding, the celebration, the whatever. And when he came back from the trip, he said, "Are you serious? Are you going to do this?" And I said, "Yeah, I am." And part of that was being really open with everyone around me to hold me to account. You know, I just put it out there, I'm giving up drinking on New Year's. And everyone's like, "No, you won't." But I think, like most people who have had that thought and that reaction, when you tell other people, it's so, you know, I really doubted that I'd be able to do it, because so many people were like, "Why would you do that? And why aren't you fun anymore? And where's this come from? And are you having a breakdown?" You know, it was all this really, you know, heavy stuff about, but it, you could, you know, on reflection now, I can see that it's a reflection on who they are.
Who you're talking to, absolutely. Now, hang on, wait, there's a lot. And I want to go back before we go forward to that when you quit. You're talking about that, you know, I'm a curious person and I had that curiosity going on and I was studying psychology. So you had an inner dialogue. There was the drinking Greer and then the observing one. Can you sort of explain what that was like when you were still drinking and yet had that awareness and that inner dialogue? How did that go for you? What did it feel like?
It was a pretty dark place. I think I've always had what I would call pretty healthy mental health, if that's such a thing. I've had a little bit of anxiety in the past, but I've usually been pretty upfront with myself, because I have what I think is a really acute self-awareness of who I am as a person. Some people would say that's probably an arrogance, but I think I'm very aware of my flaws, and so I guess when I was in those places where I was drinking and actively knowing I was numbing, I was kind of almost giving myself permission to do that, because I knew there would be an end point. I knew there would be a fork in the road where it was going to get too far. And there were two instances I can think of. One was when I'd run out of mixer for my alcohol, and I got in my car and I drove literally a couple of hundred meters, not on a public road. And I would have been borderline, I think, potentially. And I just remember thinking, I can never do that again. And the second time was when I drove to pick my kids up from daycare, and I actually drove past their daycare so that I could get to the alcohol shop to get my Bacardi so that I could then pick them up and get back in time for bathing them. And I had a drink for bath time, and I just remember thinking, you just drove past your kids to get to an alcohol store, like, what are your priorities in life? And they're just two things that really stuck out to me of times. So I'm not really answering your question, I'm really good at that.
I don't know how you marry that sort of acutely aware, hyper focused, kind of honest version of you with the drinker, because I think, you know, once the drug's in your body and in your brain, it's really hard to kind of be that.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, I never really, I wasn't a drink to a blackout person. So yeah. I always had a certain amount of control. You know, I've never been into any other drugs for that pure reason that I like to be in control. And to me, I felt like I was in control of the drink. I was choosing to drink the drink. And I guess that's how I framed it to myself. At no stage did I feel like the drink had it over me. I was wrong. But, you know, and that's the thing, I know I'm wrong.
So fascinating, isn't it?
No, I know. It's such a dichotomy, because it's like I knew I was in control, but I also knew that I knew it was a direct result of a trauma, put it that way, that this last stage of heavy drinking that I was in. I knew that I was going through some stuff, and I just needed to drink it out. And I kind of knew that it wasn't always going to be like this, that something would happen, something really major. Either I would completely go to alcohol or I'd completely go off. And it just happens to be that I went off. Like, and I'm so lucky that that was the way that I went down, because it got to that point where I would have done something, you know, very, very career or life limiting. And it just didn't look like what I think I thought alcoholism looked like. And I still don't refer to myself as that, but I very much had a drinking problem, and I think most people have drinking problems. It just felt like I was in control, because I knew I was going to break some way, and it was just a matter of which way it fell.
And what was it like when you stopped?
I've been very, very lucky. I have had, you know, the first few days I was out at our family beach house with extended family who are all quite big drinkers, and there was a lot of curiosity from around other people, from other people, and I think that's I didn't realise how curious other people would be around why and how and that kind of feeling like you're on the outside. But I think I was pretty lucky because I'm pretty stubborn, and I was just so determined that this was going to be, and I just framed it to myself, it's going to be a year, it's fine. And within about 3 months, probably even less than that, I was like, oh geez, there's no way I'm going back to alcohol. And it was meeting people like you and other people, like our secret little club that's not so secret, you know, these women who are just, you know, with young families, with stressful jobs, with all sorts of stuff going on, hormones, you know, all these things occurring in our lives. And knowing that there was a different path and there was a secret little club of us who had given up drinking, we had rebelled, like we had given two fingers to the alcohol
right
industry.
Right,
so righteous.
That is the best fit to tap into, that kind of feeling of like, we're actually the countercultural ones, we're the feisty ones quitting.
Literally, like, we are the alties now, like we are the altie people because we're not the norm. And I was just like, this is so cool. Like, I'm cool for the first time ever. But in a really weird way, because I felt like I'd been led into a club that no one else had had these experiences. And through my studies as well, I met up with researchers. And like when I interviewed you for a story, you know, I met these amazing people and talked to these amazing people in the recovery area, in recovery areas, in research areas at Massey Uni and stuff, and just felt like, oh my gosh, there are people out there working their butts off to showcase and highlight the absolute rot that the alcohol industry is. And no one's listening.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, and it just became really angry. Yeah. Very like one of those flag waving like non-drinkers. And to the point where now I've actually had to tone myself down. So I'm like, bro, you are losing friends. Not because it's because I was very proud, I guess, of not being a drinker. And then I love to tell people, people are like, oh, should we go for a wine? I'll be like, oh, no, I don't drink. Like,
You have to kind of toe that line of having your eyes open to what a fallacy it is and all these lies we've been sold and how crazy it is, the amount of harm that's being caused and how everyone's just deluding themselves that it's beneficial all the time. And then also living in a world where people are so steeped in the culture, it's not that they're willfully ignoring it, they're I mean, I was like this, it literally just can't, don't see it. So absolutely. You know, there's this great saying you probably heard about, attraction not persuasion, where it actually, by us just living our lives, not drinking, having a great time, occasionally getting a little bit feisty, but just living, is the one of the most powerful things that we can do.
That's right. And I think that every now and then I go through these fits and stages where on Instagram I'll go on a bit of a rant. Like, I remember before Christmas I pulled out a whole bunch of circulars in my letterbox and I went through them one by one, showcasing all the alcohol ones or even the ones that weren't about alcohol. You know, they're selling swimming pools, but there was alcohol in the photo or whatever. And I went, look at all this alcohol and look at the pinkification, which I love that word that you talk about. And I was just kind of like, look, people, look. And you know, a couple of people replied, but not many. And then, because I was just on a rant and I was like, okay, it's out of my system now. That's good. I can let it go for a little while. But then out of the blue, through that, people would contact me. And I still get contacted now by people who follow me on Instagram who I don't know from a bar of soap, who'll say, hey, can I talk to you about my drinking? And I'm just like, oh, my God, please, let's talk about your drinking. Like, I'm so grateful because it shows that just by, exactly like you're saying, just by living my life, by people seeing me, going out and doing everything else that you're doing other than vomiting in a bush, you know, that's all I can do. And I'm proud and happy to do that.
Yeah, awesome. Okay, so we've got a sense of the sort of curious, intellectually sharp, you know, version of you that has loved, well, had a real keen eye on the drinking and now loves being sober and has been really kind of lifted up by all of the movement around trying to, you know, help other people and change our culture. But I'm interested also in the kind of emotional version of you, because you're talking about numbing, and there was stuff going on in your relationship and maybe other things, and that alcohol was helping with those. So how did that go when you took away that kind of tool and you had to be raw all the time? Because that's what a lot of people don't get about not drinking. It's not that we're resisting at parties and stuff. It's that every single day, no matter what we feel it.
Exactly. And that, I think that you hit that key word, raw, which was the first thing that came to my mind. It was all of the feelings all of the time. And it is overwhelming. I would say I've been very lucky in that maybe it was my studies at the time and just my general interest in the readings that I was doing and what I was being attracted to at the time in terms of kind of self-development and stuff, that I feel like I was very kind to myself and that I could feel it all happening inside and I knew the reason why. But certainly, you know, the things that I've, you know, those real high peaks of things, grief, trauma, stress. Stress is a huge one for me because I do overload myself with things. Mm. And when it all comes crashing down, you know, the lockdowns, the plural, you know, all sorts of stuff I've been involved in the past couple of years with my work. So many stressful points. And to not have that backstop of alcohol has been really, really difficult. What I would say is that very quickly I developed my own ritual. So and it was something that my husband started doing for me as well, is when I had a stressful day, he'd say, "Do you want a drink?" And I'd say, "Yes." And it wasn't an alcoholic drink, but he'd pour me a nice drink of something else. You know, I love seed lip and ginger ale. It's my favourite thing ever. And he would pour that for me so that I still had that ritual of, oh, God, it's been a tough day, and I can breathe and I can relax, enjoy this drink, I can be in the moment. And it has the exact same effect. And it's right. So hard to try and explain to people that you can have that whole ritualistic effect. It doesn't need to be alcohol in the glass. Yeah. And the same happens with, you know, wedding. Obviously, I'm involved in lots of weddings and the alcohol is flowing and people are saying, have a glass of bubbles. Look, give me a glass of juice and we're still having a great time. It's actually not about what's in the cup. It's the ritual and it's the habit of holding something. And so I guess from an emotional perspective, I still have that. I feel like I'm being kind to myself by still engaging in that ritual of knowing that, you know, the stress hits. Normally I would go to alcohol. I'm still going to go through the ritual of pouring myself something, but I'm not going to have alcohol. Like
does it work as well? I mean, what else do you do to deal with stress? I mean, obviously a nice glass of seed lip and ginger ale is great at 5, but when you're really stressed, what other kind of coping mechanisms and techniques have you developed?
I've leaned really heavily into the gym. So I used to go to F45 and currently I go to Orange Theory, which is, you know, team group fitness kind of classes. It's quite high impact, high energy, kind of feels like you're in a nightclub sometimes. Yeah. But that cool. To me just gets it out of my system. And then I'm like, I went this morning and my body's still kind of shaking now, to be honest. And it's, to me, it's about honouring myself, I guess, and just being, you know, like really kind to myself. And also just things like walking the dogs, you know, actually playing with the kids, not sitting there thinking, it's 12 o'clock, do you think I could probably get away with a wine now because it's been a day with the kids, you know, like, you know, children are the biggest, most stressful thing I've ever experienced in my life. Mothering is so hard.
I had to give myself a stern talking to this morning because I was trying to read an email and my 12-year-old was babbling about something and I was like, yeah, I was half listening, and then I actually caught myself and I said, Lotta, stop with the email and turn and listen to him. He's going to school in 3 minutes and you'll be on your own to do emails or whatever. And I had to really because it's so relentless.
They're
at you constantly and they babble away and we love them, but we've got to acknowledge mothering is hard. There's a reason a lot of mums drink, and there's a reason why the liquor industry targets mums, because it is a hard job. It's draining and it's boring and it's wonderful, but it is those other things as well.
Absolutely. Like I've definitely, I think it's the biggest thing in my life that I've struggled with. And it was a very key trigger for me for drinking, and certainly I was not short of other women in the same position who were keen to drink with me, which is kind of equal parts scary and quite sad, actually, that a lot of us are operating in these kind of zones where we feel like that's the only way out or the only support that we do have. Yeah, I mean, there's so many habits outside of just drinking that I've had to change, like even going to a friend's house for dinner, and normally I'd take a bottle of wine, and I'm like, actually, I don't really support this industry. And so, like, what's the go now with buying alcohol for friends or whatever? And
wait, you would take a bottle of wine to give to the host as a kind of arrival gift as a guest.
Yeah.
Even when you were sober, you would do that.
Yeah, because I felt like, oh, I know that they like drinking, so therefore I'll get them. So I don't know. It was just like, again, a habit, I guess, that's what I would bring. You know, what else do you bring? Do you bring a 1.5 of Sprite? You know,
flowers or chocolate?
Yeah. Well, that's the thing, is that I've had to shift, right? And now you're right. I do go to flowers. So where I would go and visit a mum friend and with our children screaming and all that kind of stuff, where I would normally go and take a bottle of wine, I'll take them flowers now. I'll take them some donuts for their kids so that they shut up for 5 minutes. You know, like, and that's again like another kind of associated behavior, I think, that I didn't really take into account that I'd have to change, or not have to change, but want to change, because, like you said, I've had a peek behind the curtains now and I didn't like what I saw.
Well, all these cultural norms. The other one I often come up against is the email that goes around at the end of the cricket season or the football season, which says, hey, everyone, let's get something for the parent who volunteered as coach. Any suggestions? And it's always booze.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I try and stay quiet because I don't want to be too much of a, I mean, I already put myself out there so much in terms of the not drinking, anti-alcohol kind of stance. But every now and then I'll try and get in first and I'll say, what about this great cookbook? Or what about a voucher to the local, you know, family pub place for a meal? Or just try and put something in there that's not that go-to gift, because we're always buying alcohol for coaches. But it is everywhere. You get it at the, you know, you buy a house, your real estate agent will give you wine. You go to the hairdresser, do you want a wine? You know,
we sold our house 18 months ago, and our real estate agent we knew, and he actually made a hamper for us, and it didn't include alcohol. It was so touching because he deliberately did that because he knew I didn't drink. And I was like, that's so, like, I so appreciated that, because it becomes so awkward that there's an assumption there. And once you actually break it down, it actually is quite culturally insensitive as well, you know, giving alcohol to people who you don't know what their religious beliefs are. And it's really, I think that's how I try and frame it up when people kind of inject alcohol into things, where there's a group of people from different backgrounds or what have you. I always try to, rather than be like, alcohol's the devil, I'm more like, guys, there might be some in our group who don't drink or whatever, you know, maybe we should go down this route or whatever. Because it's, you know, there was a great, I don't know if you saw it lately, but recently with the Australian cricket team, did you see what the captain did? So normally when they finished, it was the Australian team, they'd won.
Saw the headline,
They went to spray the champagne, and so the Muslim person in the team ran away, and the captain actually stopped everyone and said, no, you come here, get in the photo with everyone, and actually held them all back. And they were all cheering and happy because they just won. They didn't need alcohol in the photo, but it was such a and I don't say this often about Australians, you know, such a wonderful insight into inclusivity. I can never say that word.
But these little things are starting to happen, chipping away. Exactly, I mean, chipping. But I wanted to just pick up on what you said about not wanting to be like alcohol is the devil. There is a line we have to tread, because the bottom line is, Greer, there are people that can have a very moderate relationship with that drug, and alcohol's not going anywhere. Prohibition, you know, it didn't work when they tried it in the States last century. People have a right to choose, and they can also have a right to make bad decisions if that's what they want to do. So we have to kind of have this line of, yes, we think alcohol is harmful and destructive and obviously wasn't our friend, but there are people who can moderate it and it should be available. So I'm always trying to tread this line of kind of anti, but also understanding it's going to be around. And just my thing is always, I just want to change the environment that we're in, because the pendulum swung too far that it's normalized and glorified. And we have to come back to where, yes, it's around, but it's not marketed everywhere. It's not cheap. It's not in the bloody supermarkets. Do you know what I mean about having to tread that line of understanding that there are going to be people who do want to and can drink?
Yeah. And it's also normalizing choice as well. So being able to know that when you go to a restaurant or something, that you will have something more than Diet Coke to choose from, you know. And actually, you know, there's a very good reason why the alcohol, and I even struggle with this, that the alcohol companies are making so much money and there's so much growth off non-alcoholic or alcohol removed products. And it's, my brother actually works for a large alcohol company in New Zealand, which is, you know, slightly awkward because, you know, when we have talked about it, and we don't talk often about it, but when we do, he's always said, oh, you know, it's our largest market, our largest growth market at the moment.
Is that right?
Is making alcohol-free items. And I'm just like, it's like smokeless cigarettes. I can't even understand. It's, but I mean, I can understand, but they must be quivering. And you know that when you back into put these massive companies, you back them into a corner, you know that they just get more and more aggressive with marketing. And you know, the way we got all those circulars through the letterbox and stuff, because they know, they can see the writing on the wall that change is coming. And you're right, I don't think it's going to be an elimination. It's like when, you know, TV came in and everyone said radio would die. It's not a death of something, but it's certainly a re-engineering or rethinking around certain things. And look, they're trying to diversify by creating these products, but I think the writing is on the wall, and we are very much, I'd say, even, and you would have noticed it yourself, the options have changed in the past couple of years.
My goodness, unbelievable, the growth, the explosion, and non-alcoholic.
Well, I'm already ahead of the curve here. Like, I said to my husband once, God, I wish that we'd like invested in some alcohol-free company like years ago, because I knew this was going to happen and I knew we were going to be cool. And like, if only I just had some extra money to throw at a company, like, we'd be rolling in it right now.
I know. It's so good though, isn't it? Because it means less people hopefully are in that dark place that you and I were both in when our drinking was just pulling us down. But I mean, it's a good thing that those companies are are diversifying and having more, you know, putting some money into the non-alcoholic options, but they will have to feel some pain like the tobacco industry did. If the government's brave enough to change regulations around alcohol and really change our culture, which is what needs to happen, then the alcohol industry will suffer. But I sort of have faith that, you know, other things will come up and create jobs in different areas for those people that might not have them anymore. But, yeah, I'm convinced we're going to look back at this time of alcohol saturation and just be gobsmacked. You know, like when I tell my kids now, we used to smoke at the movies, we used to smoke on the bus, we used to smoke on aeroplanes.
And they're like,
what?
The little curtain in the middle of the plane, like it somehow stops the smoke wafting through.
I'm pretty sure we'll get to a day where we come, where we go, you know, we used to give alcohol to school sports coaches. Yeah. And, you know, people who bought, you know, real estate agents would give it to you when you bought a house. Yeah. I mean, I'm hoping anyway, maybe it's wishful thinking.
I think the change is already very much happening. Like I look at kind of some of the younger people in my life who are, you know, teens or in their early 20s, and, you know, alcohol, the binge drinking as such, I feel like, is not such a big teen thing anymore.
I
hate to say, it sounds like other drugs are kind of getting in there instead, which is awful.
But, well, and also, sorry to cut you off, but I was just going to say, I also did interview an epidemiologist for my last book, and she said that they're also thinking that it might also be things like social media and kind of isolation that's impacting on the drinking habits, which also isn't a great thing.
Yeah.
So it's not necessarily that they're just trying to be healthy, but they're just maybe not getting.
I'm just wondering if that flow on effect when they become adults and they have families and that, whether they will still have the same devices, you know, like whether, sorry, not devices, vices, as in will they look to alcohol to numb their pain, or will they look to something else? Will they look to online gaming or you know, other things that are not alcohol, if they haven't got that pattern from teenagehood. I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, but they're going to try and have to find ways to deal with emotions because being a human's hard. Hopefully they'll be like you and they'll get fit and they'll get all their endorphins from doing nightclub exercise. I wish that were me. Sadly, no. But there are other ways to deal with emotions. They're just sort of subtler and more gentle, and they're not as quick. The quick fix of the glass of wine, that quick fix, it works in the moment. A lot of those more authentic ways to deal with stuff, they don't have that immediate, but in the long term, they are definitely more grounding.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, like you said, like going back to that emotional thing, I think my default is always to get curious. So what I have enjoyed is kind of reading more than I used to, because in the past, you know, you can't read drunk. That is just so impossible to do. Being able to watch a Netflix documentary, and to be fair, I do still fall asleep on the couch, but at least it's not with a drink in my hand.
And you remembered everything up to the point.
I remembered it, yeah, exactly. So there are those real little, like when those emotional kind of moments hit, I think I just dig really deep. And yeah, like you said, maybe other people don't even really see what I do, but it might be that I go into my room and listen to a podcast for an hour that addresses the thing that I'm thinking about, or maybe is completely frivolous and about like, you know, Hollywood breakups or something, you know, like just. So I have those other little coping mechanisms.
And you can have an option.
Yeah, talking more, like just like quoting Brené Brown here, but like, you know, that vulnerability of being able to just be like, today was really tough and I feel like, you know, whatever. And being able to have those conversations with people around you. I really enjoyed that aspect of it, not having to have that like liquid courage to talk about things that are maybe like, you know, filled with hurt or shame or whatever they are, and just deal with them. I know it feels more genuine when it's a sober conversation, obviously, rather than a one that's covered in alcohol.
And I bet that's had an impact on your relationship.
Massively. I mean, I think by default my husband definitely drinks a lot less more. He's lost his drinking buddy. But he still drinks. I think, like I've heard you say, Corin, you know, occasionally does. I mean, I think the only thing I've really noticed is just how disgusting alcohol breath is. Like,
oh,
I'm just like, get away from me.
I had it the other night. Corin doesn't drink much, but the other night I was literally like, it was, I didn't want to make him feel bad.
No, it's chemical, really, like, it doesn't, you know, I still love the smell of alcohol.
I just don't
want
to go near it.
And stuff. And now all I smell is, like, it smells like nail polish remover to me. Like, it smells so toxic. And and it amazed me how quickly that happened after I stopped drinking. It's kind of like what they say with smokers, you know, like, you know, after X amount of time, your taste buds start coming back and all that kind of stuff. And you can smell different things. And that's how I felt after alcohol. I was like, oh my God, you guys stink. And like things like bars smell, walking past bars on Courtney Place or something, I'm like, oh.
So is it safe to say, Greer, that you're never going to pick up alcohol again?
I don't think so. Like, I've always been very careful never to say never. I think mainly because I'm petrified that like I'll be at a party one day or something and I'll pick up what I think is my beer and drink someone else's.
I've done that once.
Yeah, and then I'll just completely, you know, think that everything's lost and all that kind of stuff. And I do kind of have moments where I'm like, yeah, could I moderate again? And it's kind of like I listened to your chat with Matt Kalman the other day and he had it bang on where he was like, maybe I am in a place where I can moderate now. And I have those thoughts every now and then. I'm like, oh, I think I could go and have one. But I just know deep down I couldn't. So I will certainly, I do not intend to drink again. Which sounds to me like quite a big thing to say when I know that hopefully I've got a much longer life ahead of me. And so, you know, if I live to my 80s, 90s, that's another 40, 50 years away.
And you don't actually have to think about that. You just have to think about today or tomorrow. Am I going to drink today or tomorrow? No.
Yeah, exactly. And that's kind of how I've framed it up, is I've never said, because some people have asked that, oh, are you ever going to do it? One of the things they always have brought up for some reason, you know, I have a daughter and they say, will you not drink at your daughter's wedding? And I was like, Like, why, what on earth? Like, I haven't drunk at all these other events. Why that one specific event? Not even my son, but my daughter's wedding. What, were you not raise a glass of champagne? And I was like, I have no intention of doing that. And what on earth does that mean in the context of, like,
well, because you're sort of thinking of that golden event. And when I was quitting, funnily enough, that I often talk about that last morning I sat on the loo in floods of tears. It was 3 in the morning after my last ever binge, and I was about to make the decision to quit, and I was literally going in my mind, what about my son's weddings? And they were like 5 and 3 at the time.
Yeah.
And yet here I was in the future, miserable at one of the happiest days of my life, but miserable purely because of the liquid that was in my glass. Like, that was the hold it had over me.
Exactly. And when you actually break it down to that, it's mind-blowing to think of the control and the emphasis that we put on something that is just not worth it.
Well, what a wonderful note to end on. You are amazing. I'm so happy you've joined the Cool Sober gang. And thanks for coming on my sobriety chat. Keep up the great work, and we'll catch you soon.
Cool. See you later.
See ya.